is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I have really a great pleasure for me talking to Lorna Landvik about her newest book called Best to Laugh. But I've read a number of her books, and I've been a big fan of Lorna's writing for a really long time, so this is really fun for me. How are you, Lorna?
I am wonderful. Thank you so much for having me on your podcast.
Oh, I'm happy to do it. You know, I found this book accidentally. I was wandering around at the last day of Book Expo in New York and walked past the University of Minnesota exhibit, and they were kind enough to give me a copy of your book. I was really surprised to see you published by University Press. And maybe before we talk about the book, I'm just curious how you ended up giving this book to them.
Oh, that's kind of a loaded question. I had written a book. I actually started it. It would have been my third book. I wrote about 50 pages, and it, much to my surprise, into this mild-mannered actuary's life came a bunch of fun-loving aliens. And I thought, what? And I couldn't wait to proceed, but my editor at the time wanted to see what I was working on. And when I sent her the 50 pages, and around page 50, that's where the aliens suddenly appear in this guy's childhood bedroom. And my editor said, "You can't write about aliens." And I thought, oh, come on, it's going to be so fun. But I couldn't argue with my editor. So I put those pages away, but they percolated through the years. And ultimately, I thought, I have to find out what happens to this guy named Fletcher Weschel and these fun-loving aliens. So I finished the book, and a new editor had the same reaction. She didn't want me writing about aliens. She thought it didn't jibe with my brand. And I don't like to have a brand. I like to write a new book every time. And so that ultimately led me to self-publish, which was brutal. You know, some people are really good at it. I was raised, you know, my heritage is all Norwegian, Lutheran household. So, you know, that lesson, don't toot your own horn, was really, you know, hammered into me. So promotion-wise, I was very bad. And then publishing is just changing so much. You know, I think publishers used to support their writers knowing that their career arcs had some ups and downs. But now it's just so money-driven, it seems to me. And, you know, there's so many big conglomerates owning publishing houses now. And so a friend of mine who had also been published by a New York house said, hey, the University of Minnesota Press is now doing fiction. They've just published my latest book, and I'm very happy with the result. You should talk to them. So I did. And not only did they want to publish Best to Laugh, they said they'd like to reissue Mayor of the Universe. And so they spiffed it all up. I had sent it out into the world. You know, my beloved child, oh, and it was full of typos, and it was like, you know, bringing my son to kindergarten with, you know, a bad case of head lice and a runny nose. So I was thrilled that they gave that book a new life as well. So that's how I got there.
No, it's terrific. I think, and I think you're right that the publishing business has changed, and my father was a writer, and they, you know, in years and years ago, publishers would typically stay with a writer for a really long period of time and kind of go, as you said, with the ups and downs, looking for a career arc that might eventually lead them to making some money. I mean, they still had to make money, but I think they took a longer term view than many publishers are able to do today, where there's more pressure on them to make an immediate quarterly profit than a long-term investment.
So, right, and even the language seems to have changed. You know, they used to call books books, and now I hear products so much of the time. And I just don't like the merchandising aspect, you know. If I did, I would have gone into merchandising.
Well, so do you think that, I mean, I actually didn't intend to ask you this question, but do you think that that this changes the way you look at your publishing your books in the future?
You know, for my own sanity, I just have to, when I'm working on a book, I just have to concentrate on the book I'm working on. And then I feel when I'm done with it, then I decide what my next step is. My first goal is always to finish what I'm working on.
Right. Well, that makes sense. When you're writing, you have to concentrate on the writing. So, well, let's talk a little bit about Best to Laugh. I think, you know, I looked in, I know that the story has some personal connection to you, and that, and I did not realize this until I read the book, that you had been in California, I guess, in the early 80s.
Yeah.
In Los Angeles. You went out there essentially as a young kid, young adult, to try to make your way as a stand-up comedian. And, I mean, that's just such an amazing idea. And, of course, the character in the book goes out there thinking about that, but kind of lands in the middle of this great slew of people who are, some of them the old Hollywood, you know, survivors from the earlier days, and others who are struggling and trying to be successful themselves in the period that she's in. And does that reflect pretty much the kinds of people and the physical place that you actually lived in?
Yes, and I love how you called it a great slew. If you could, I'm thinking S-L-O-U-G-H or S-L-E-W, and it's perfect. Yes, we landed in the most fabulous Hollywood Boulevard complex. It was called Peyton Hall. It had embossed palm trees on the dining room wallpaper. It had rattan tiki hut wallpapered ceilings. It had an Olympic-sized swimming pool designed by Douglas Fairbanks, and old tenants who'd wander around, you know, smoking and saying things like, "I was Veronica Lake stand-in." And you would see, you know, the young people whose careers were just taking off. You'd also see the results of a career that had gone into a deep decline. Peyton Hall was torn down. We did put up a valiant fight to have it declared a historical landmark, but now a big condominium sits where Peyton Hall used to be. And after its demolition, I would have a recurring dream, and I would have it about four times a year. And I would always wake up, it was about, you know, the demolition of Peyton Hall, and I'd wake up feeling very disquieted. And so finally, after all those years, I thought, well, I want to write about that time. I want to pay homage to, you know, the Hollywood that I knew when I was in my 20s. And the main character, Candy, shares similar dreams, but she's very much unlike me in that, much to my surprise, her mother turned out to be a Korean War bride. And for me, that's the fun of fiction. You just, what? You know, but that's how she presented herself to me. She has a very rough and tragic childhood. I did not have that kind of childhood. But I did put her in situations that I was in when I lived in LA. I did temp at the Playboy Mansion, and it was strictly clerical. I did work for Atlantic Records. I have her working in this small boutique record company. And I did live on Hollywood Boulevard. That was my neighborhood. And if ever I had a temp job that was near, like on Sunset Boulevard or Hollywood Boulevard, I would always roller skate to it and, you know, slalom around the stars on the Walk of Fame. And it was, you know, Hollywood Boulevard had a real seedy aspect to it, and now it's gotten much more gentrified, I think. And I don't know if I like the gentrification as much as I like the old kind of seediness.
Yeah, well, I think actually the old LA, maybe the older the better, I think.
Yeah.
You know, I just, you know, it's, we, I mean, part of our views of it are made by television and film, you know, that kind of history that we imagine it to have had, but some of it is real, and it was definitely different. Mm-hmm. Much less, I don't know, there's something about LA that it, you know, it continually reinvents itself. And, I mean, you captured some of that, you know, in the, you know, the, whatever's old is old, you know, it's gone and kind of forgotten very quickly there.
Right.
It's all about what's new, and new generations want the new thing. Although I think periodically, you know, I was out there recently and I talked to a guy who had, I spent a couple of years there when I was a kid, and he grew up very near where I had lived. So we had this, you know, conversation about what it was like in L.A. in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
And there's sort of that, there is a certain amount of wistfulness of people who lived there, just as you have that feeling about the 80s.
Right.
You know, and you kind of, I think you captured it really well in this book. But also the way that L.A. captures the imagination of people and brings them out there, as your character does. You know, you just feel drawn to the energy there.
You know, I can't think of a more perfect place where I could have spent my 20s. And, you know, as a kid in Minneapolis, I was always a fan of The Late Show and all the old movies. And so I had a real interest in, you know, motion pictures and the history of Hollywood, and to go out there and to, you know, have fellow tenants who owned Ciro's nightclub, or there was one old screenwriter who we used to take out for lunch, and he would tell us how really you'd get a headache from the smell of orange blossoms and jacaranda. You know, it was just so heavy in the air. And I'm one of the, well, I can't say few people, but a lot of people always have, you know, negative things to say about L.A. And I loved L.A. I think it's wonderful.
So was there, I mean, I think one of the characters that you just talked about is the guy that owned an old, you know, an important nightclub. It was, his name in the book is Frank Flover.
Right.
But he has a son, or Francis Flover, sorry, he has a son who is a punk rocker. Was that, you know, did that really happen too?
Yes. the guy's real name was Herman Hover, and he had a son named Ian, who was the first punk rocker that I met, and he would bring over his friends to our house and, you know, to our apartment, and they'd introduce themselves like, "Hi, I'm Rock Bottom." You know, "Oh, hi, Rock." And Herman was one of those people who had, you know, reached a real pinnacle in Hollywood, knew everybody, hosted everybody in his nightclub, and then his fortunes took a terrible tumble. And most of the characters are made up, but a few of them, like Francis Flover, are based on real characters. We did have a landlord who was startlingly handsome and who was up for the role of Errol Flynn in a to-be-made biopic. And it never happened, and you'd see his eyes get more and more bloodshot. And and the beauty of fiction, too, I usually never write autobiographically, so this definitely was a first for me, but the fiction part far outweighs the autobiography, and then the fun of fiction allowed me to, you know, maybe give some people a more hopeful or happier ending than they actually had in real life.
So did you, now your main character creates a stage name for herself, which is actually pretty funny. Did you also do that when you were doing stand-up? Did you have a stage name?
I never did. Nope. It's the same name as I bear today.
So you know, your main character kind of has this feeling, it's not really expressed, but she has this feeling that her mother, well, she knows her mother was funny, doesn't know her mother well, because she had died when she's so young, but did you always feel like you were funny and that you wanted this opportunity to express yourself and that the way you thought of it was to do comedy?
You know, I really did. And I just, that was my natural personality, probably assisted by the fact that I had older brothers, you know, and humor is always a good mediation tool, you know, better to make somebody laugh than to get smacked by them. And my family was funny. My parents were funny. And I'm always flattered when, you know, when I've been on book tours out of the state and people say, you know, I find your books really funny. And I'll say, thank you. But, you know, they have such a questioning tone to their voice. And then they'll say, but you said that you were, you know, your background is Norwegian. And yeah. So we don't have a great reputation for humor, but I think, you know, Norwegians are just as funny as anybody else.
Well, it is true. I had to laugh because there is that, you know, certainly the image of the Scandinavians as being serious, and you know, but of course it's not true. But I find all of your books funny, and you know, they're laugh out loud funny. You know, they're when you're reading and all of a sudden you're laughing, and you know, the person sitting next to you gets really irritated because they're not participating in the joke. That happens to me when I read your book or your books.
I'm
not just this one.
Well, I can't thank you enough for reading my books, because I love when men read my books. I don't think they're exclusively directed to women. They're about people. And yet I know some of the titles aren't going to lure a man into a bookstore so he can say, yeah, have you got that Angry Housewife Eating Bonbons? Wrap it up, please. Or how about that Patty Jane's House of Curls? So sometimes I think, oh, maybe my titles aren't as inviting to men as they could be. So the men who come out to my readings or who write me, I really acknowledge their enlightenment and thank them.
Well, there is, I do think it is, there is some element to that in the titles of the book. You kind of feel like, you know, that in your, when you're in the bookstore, if you pick a book off the shelf that looks like it's for the other gender,
right.
You know, people will look at you strangely, but, you know, that's almost like saying, well, women should feel strange reading, you know, Kon-Tiki or something, you know?
Exactly.
No one thinks those stories aren't universal, so.
Exactly.
It is kind of unfair. And I don't think your book, I don't think of your books as being women centric in some way. I mean, they're not, you know, I mean, they don't fail to have a woman's perspective, but I've never felt that they were exclusionary in any way.
And I knew as soon as I heard your voice that you were enlightened. So thank you.
Oh, well, thank you. I'll make sure that I, you know, that's what I will save from this interview, is that I'm enlightened. So one thing I noticed on the cover, when I first looked at it, I thought it said best laugh. Did your designer do that on purpose?
Which cover are you looking at? Because it had, at BEA, it had a different cover than the one that was finally used.
I think this is the printed book. It's a hardcover with a pale green cover.
Oh, yeah, that's the cover that was used, yep.
Yeah, and it's just sort of funny that they made the word two fairly small, which, I don't think that's a problem or it's bad or anything. I actually liked the fact that I misread it and just read it as best laugh.
You know what? I just ran upstairs to look at it, and I never even noticed that, and you are right. Wow, you got a sharp eye. Yeah, I never... Wow, that's very interesting.
Yeah, it's not a bad thing at all. I thought it kind of made me think about it a little bit.
Maybe that was the designer's idea.
Yeah, well, I think it worked. But best to laugh, and I won't, again, not giving anything away, best to laugh is a key element in the book, and we don't find that out until the very end, which I really liked. So Do you see, you know, when you think about the character, Candy, whose stage name is Oe, so it's Candy Oe, sounds like a county in Minnesota that is spelled completely differently. Is it a Finnish word, Candy Oe, do you think?
See, I'm a Minnesotan, so we pronounce it Candy Ojai.
Ah, see, I don't even know that, so.
Yeah, well, how are you to know that unless you go on road trips in Minnesota, as I do? I don't know if it's Finnish. It's spelled K-A-N-D-Y-O-H-E.
It's Ojai,
something like that. And I think it may be Finnish. It may be Native American.
Yeah, it could be Ojibwe or something.
I'm going to look it up as soon as I hang up.
So, but how do you what do you imagine for her, for Candy? What happens after the book ends? I'm really actually curious about that because this takes place in an early part of her life, and I know writers don't always, you know, you don't always want to write another book about the same character. But I think you have, once you have a character in your imagination, they have a life, and I'm kind of curious what's become of her.
Well, as a reader, I am very fond of prologues and epilogues. I like the introduction, the invitation of a prologue, and I like the kind of the PS of an epilogue. And so as a writer, I almost always write a prologue and an epilogue. And my epilogue sort of helped me say goodbye to the book and the characters, you know, because when I get to the end, it is the end, but then, oh, here's a little glimpse of, you know, what happens next. So usually when I'm done writing the epilogue, I'm ready to write another book. And so I'm thinking about those characters. But I do think Candy had turned much more toward writing and not so much performing. So by now, maybe she's collected her second Nobel Prize for literature. I don't know. I wish her the best.
Well, she certainly deserves it. I thought she was a great character. And, you know, I liked it that she was half Korean and, you know, kind of caught in those, in that complexity of having a different look than the average person growing up in Minnesota.
Right. And she was just surrounded by, you know, people who look like they came off a Viking ship. And so, yeah, it was really interesting for me to consider that and imagine what that, you know, that sense of otherness would be, even though the main person in her life is her Norwegian grandmother.
Oh, I loved her grandmother. That was great.
And
it was great that you gave her, you know, a late romance, too. That was fun. So did you, when you were working in the Playboy Mansion, did you in fact meet Hugh Hefner in the way that your character meets that stand-in character?
I had the same job that I gave Candy, although in the book she's working at the Rogue Mansion, right, where there are rascalettes and not playmates. But so I cataloged a lot of videotapes for Hugh Hefner up in his video room. And it really was a fun kind of job for a kindergartner. You know, I would type labels like Miss January 1980 opens Ralph Supermarket. And then I got to watch movies and, you know, write synopses, because then there wasn't the internet to, you know, look up. And he had big, thick tomes of, you know, movie history. And so sometimes I'd rifle through those, but sometimes I'd actually get to watch the movie and write a synopsis. And only twice I had to deliver cassette tapes to his bedroom. And I raced in there and placed those, you know, tapes down and raced out and then washed my hands after I got out. But I only met Hugh Hefner occasionally in the hallway in passing, and he would say hello, but I never had the conversation that Candy has with him.
It's just so funny, you know, to imagine.
Yeah, I know. It was a really the most surreal temp job I could ever imagine. I mean, we would get there in the morning and you could order breakfast from the cooks. At lunch, you would get, you know, leftovers from the party buffet the night before. At 3 o'clock, a butler would bring up a silver tea service with cookies and tea and coffee. And the working environment, I mean, they were very good to their employees, but to me, a feminist, I just thought they were very good to employees to make you forget where you were, you know. And you would, playmates would be strolling around, peacocks would be on the emerald green grounds, you know, and it was, when I got back to Minneapolis, my first temp job was at American Family Insurance, which was a little bit different than the Playboy Mansion.
So, but, you know, it's just funny to imagine, you know, a young person, I mean, anybody could do this, go out to California or go anywhere, but, you know, it's just amazing the experiences that you actually did have. It's kind of magical that you happened to be in the right place at the right time.
Well, I think that could be Hollywood's motto, you know, being at the right place, in the right place at the right time. And, you know, for my acting career, I feel I may have been in the right place many times, but I didn't know what to do with the right place. You know, I just,
right.
I wasn't assertive in my career the way I was in my writing career. And I think because the writing career mattered the most. So I never accepted no as my final answer. Whereas in Hollywood, when I, you know, if I were at a casting call or something and I heard a no, I never fought like, hey, let me do that again. I'll show you. You know, it was always, thank you. Bye. Can I get you some coffee? You know, so, and, you know, it's really hard for women in Hollywood. You know, there's such a huge disparity in, you know, the number of pictures. Listen to me, I call them pictures. In the, you know, the movie starring men versus those starring women. And sometimes it seems like the golden age for women, you know, passed and is gone, you know, and from the 1930s, you know, and never rose up again. And the stuff I was getting sent out on was very stupid. You know, I'd get sent out for young ingenue parts and boy, what I'd love to be sent on one of those now. But, you know, never fun character parts, which is really what I love to do. And when I moved back to Minneapolis, I did a lot more fun comic acting than I ever did in L.A.
Do you still act? Do you still do
I do a show a year at this fabulous place we have called the Bryant Lake Bowl, which is an old vintage bar, restaurant, bowling alley, and then they have a theater next to it. So occasionally you hear the crash of pins while you're on stage. But I was with an improvisational company here called Dudley Riggs, and that led me to do a lot of stuff with a lot of people. Theater companies were formed. And so now I do a show a year at the Bryant Lake Bowl called Party in the Rec Room, and it's all improvised. It's just me and a blender full of margaritas on stage, and I just make up characters on the spot from audience suggestions.
You mean people can just jump up and say, play that lady on the trailer or something like that?
No, I'll say, like, what's your favorite cologne, David? And you would say,
no, that's interesting. I have no clue.
Oh, well, I would ask a bunch of questions. And if you had no clue, you know, somebody else would yell something
somebody
out.
Will. Yeah.
And I might say, give me a book you read last year. What's a food I'll never find in your refrigerator? And then from those three suggestions, I go backstage to all my props and wigs and grab something and come out again and hope that I will have a character that uses all those suggestions well. And it's really, really fun. And sometimes I'm just frantically sifting through wigs like, what? Excalibur, the cologne, sushi, you know, and I have to come out and do a character based on all those suggestions. So,
would you ever consider doing that sort of as a on tour where, you know, instead of doing a traditional book tour and reading and talking, you could do comedy? And
I would love to do that. And I have done that in other venues, you know, not in Minneapolis, but again, I gotta get a team. I gotta get a promotional team to, you know, get me out there, because I'm so bad at promotion. So if you can work on that, where you, on your end, it's a deal.
All right, it's a deal. I'll be your promoter.
Okay. That.
I think that's probably the best I can do. I can't perform and I can't write, so. Two things you can do. So you do need somebody who can be your, you know, your promoter, I think.
I'm shameless.
So one thing I want to ask about is, although you may not want to talk about it, but are you writing a book now, or do you, I mean, are you?
I am writing a book now. And I usually don't talk about it because it's, you know, it changes so much while I'm writing it. So I just kind of like to keep it close to the vest, but I seem to have talked about it somewhere, because people will tell me, oh, I heard you're writing a sequel. And so I will say that much. I am writing a sequel to my very first book, Patty Jane's House of Curl.
Wow. Well, that's exciting. And I remember those characters really well.
Yeah, those characters have always kind of kept up a low yammer, like, we want more. And I never write a book thinking to write a sequel, but these characters are being very obstreperous. Did I mispronounce that, didn't I?
No, you pronounced it.
Did
they,
I? Okay.
And they want to come out.
Yeah, they do. So I have to fling wide the gates and let them out.
Well, I will look forward to that book, because I think that will be a lot of fun. And I hope that a lot of people read Best to Laugh, because it is a lot of fun. And
well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your reading it and talking
well,
about
thank
it.
Thank you. Thanks for writing it. I think that's the most important thing. So
well, it does. It beats temping and it beats waitressing, both of which I have done enough of. Thank you.
That, I think, that's probably well put for almost any writer. I think that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me, Lorna Landvik. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk. We've been talking to Lorna Landvik about Best to Laugh, her newest book.
Thank you so much, David. Or as we say here in Minnesota, tusen tak.
Thank you.